Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Welcome to the Talky Bit. I don't know about your household, but in our household, it sort of feels like Father's Day is sponsored by Canadian Tire. And I'm saying that because I feel like we've been inundated with flyers from, you know, that retailer. Others as well, but three times more from Canadian Tire. And according to them, they know exactly what Dad needs and wants, and they have it for sale, maybe even on sale. I flipped through the flyers. It was my breakfast activity, just to see if they were right. Apparently, I do not match the What Every Dad Wants universal profile very well. I honestly didn't find a single thing in there that I had any deep desire for. Many things I would have, you know, happily had. But that's kind of interesting to me because we're in the middle of a bathroom renovation, which means that just about every other evening I feel like there's some specialty tool or other that it would be helpful to have. But here's the thing: this reno, I'm not gonna bore you with the details. It's quirky as bleep, this whole reno, because it's a reno inside a reno. But I'm not gonna get into that. Except to say this: sometimes the challenges of this project feel like they would be reduced by having, you know, a different or better tool. But more often, by far, I feel like what I need is the voice of experience. What I need is, and it's not like I haven't done some renovation and some construction. I grew up in the industry, but I need the depth that I don't have. I need the insight that comes from decades of doing and this sort of powerful combining of creativity and pragmatism. In other words, I need my dad. Right? Like that's what I feel like I need. I just want to pick up the phone and go, bloody whatever, you know, Dad, what would you do? And Dad would be like, oh, I'd do this. And then I'd go do that and it would work like a charm and, you know, that'd be great. In functional terms, I mean, I left home, practically speaking, when I was 15 to go to school outside the community. And with some relatively brief exceptions, I was gone more than home from that point on in terms of, you know, the rhythms of my life. So by the time my dad passed away in the summer of 2018, I had been away from him for decades more than I'd been with him. And although I missed him, even when he was still alive, I was also pretty accustomed to not having him around. I think we were both, as much as a parent and a child can do this, we were used to it. You know? And I think I'm just starting to realize now, at this stage of my life, how deeply impacting those early years and some of those summers I spent on his construction crews were. As I mentioned in the blurb, my dad's approach to teaching anything, including big life lessons, could be pretty subtle. It wasn't always that way. He wasn't always subtle. He could be direct. He could even be abrupt. Especially if he was dealing with something that was hands-on and the way forward just seemed terribly obvious to him, or like it should be obvious to everyone else as well, because it was obvious, which didn't always line up that great with the way that his oldest kid could sometimes seem lost in space, you know, because he was thinking about something more theoretical or philosophical. But when it came to the sorts of things that I would now call wisdom, that I would now think of as skill for living, when it came to those kind of lessons, he didn't tend to announce that he was teaching me something. He just kind of either did the thing that the lesson was carried by, or he told a story that had the lesson in it. I don't know in any
kind of definitive way how conscious he would have been of the story as carrying a lesson. I never felt like the stories were pedantic. I never felt like I was being told a story so I would get a lesson, and if I didn't get the lesson, the story was wasted. I can't remember ever having had that experience. It just, here's the story. Both of those ways of teaching seem to be a bit of a slow burn for me. The lessons take a while to emerge. Sometimes they seem to even take a very long, even a painfully long time. And that painfully long aspect sometimes includes a bunch of smaller lessons. Many of them, it seems, learned through trial and error, through failure, before the penny drops, before whatever the big theme is that was lurking there all along reveals itself. I expect there are still some lessons like that in the wings. I'd be surprised if there weren't. With all of that as context, what I want to do today is I want to share some of the life lessons that I feel like have emerged, some that I've learned, some that I'm still learning but I have words for. But these are all ones that have come to me in a discernible way from my dad. Those are personal stories, of course. My hope is that some of them will be resonant for you and that they'll prompt some of your own reflection about some of these same, if not themes, then lived experiences. I'm going to number them just because I was intrigued by how many popped out when I sat down to reflect on this. So lesson number one for my dad is, don't let what you were taught get in the way of your curiosity. So don't let the things you already think you know stop you from exploring the things you don't, might be another way to say it. I feel as though I saw this most clearly in my dad's wrestling to make practical sense, in particular, of the religious teachings that he had grown up around. But that was sort of the biggest single idea set. I mean, my dad, in a homespun way, would have been reflective and philosophical, but he wasn't educated as a philosopher. He grew up in the construction industry, hands-on, solving practical problems, but he was a thoughtful person. The biggest idea set in his life would have been the religious idea set. You know, that would have been the closest intersection to constructs that were formalized. He grew up in a deeply conservative religious and cultural context. He was Mennonite. He was the child of immigrants. And so I would say that he grew up Mennonite both religiously and I would say to a lesser degree culturally. I think as a child, very much that. And then as an adult, some of those things shifted. His dad, who was a leader in that conservative immigrant Mennonite community, which I think in some ways just pulled up just shy of kind of old colony or colony Mennonite, if that's a meaningful designation to you. But there were certainly folks in there who'd eschew zippers in favor of buttons and internal combustion engines in favor of horses in the early going. Despite the fact that his dad was a leader in that community, he was never a conformist. This is the guy who was both a village blacksmith and somebody who made his own violin from scratch. He was a poet. He was a musician who almost got himself kicked out of the church that he led because he introduced polyphony, so harmony, into the choir instead of single voice lines. And of course, I don't know, harmony makes you feel things, you know, so this might be a problem. I can only imagine what I said last week about how faith is a feeling. Every once in a while I try to imagine those, a sentence like that in that community, and it just, anyway, right? You know, so really interesting kind of context for in terms of growing up with this parent who was both somebody who was like, yes to all of these cultural expressions of religion, and also, but what about, you know, at the same time? And so that was sort of his space. And then sort of, you know, on top of that, his personal faith story included a pretty radical adult conversion story. I think in his late adolescent years, his early 20s, my dad would have described himself as a very angry person, like somebody who would get angry enough that he remembers thinking about going to kill someone he was angry with. I mean, fortunately, that feeling at that level of strength passed, and he didn't, but he considered it. That's pretty strong. That's enraged, right? That's not irritated. That's big anger. But I never knew him as an angry person. And he would say, that's part of that story. You know, it's a miraculous part of the story for him. Now, his adult conversion was also all tangled up with his romance with my mom. Not going to tell you that story now. You just got to wait for the movie. But in any case, those conservative values and dogmas really sometimes ran afoul of my dad's inherent curiosity. And two short stories that come to mind One, and these are both from later in his life. I'm already an adult when I remember encountering these things and hearing about them from him. This is a family who had, he had 13 kids, a whole bunch of kids. The number is a little unclear to me because there were two moms in this story. The first one died. Dad married that person's sister who was already helping with the young kids. So same family names, but two different sets of parents in some ways. So there's half siblings. There are siblings who didn't live very long. There's older siblings who moved away and were never around. In this story, that's one of those. It's an older sibling who was gone, I think, by the time my dad would remember them. So I knew them, saw them occasionally. They were on the West Coast. They were dying. My dad went out to see them before they died. Had this really meaningful engagement with this person who was an avowed atheist, an unusual thing in this family system. So think conservative Christianity. Where do atheists end up? Well, it's not in the good place, you know, right? And so I remember Dad coming back from this visit with this brother of his and saying to me, I'm talking to this guy about his life and I'm having this experience with him. And this is just like he's just a really lovely person. He's a really good guy. The notion that God would reject someone like that does not make any sense to me, right? So there's that intersection. So he's just working hard on this. It's like, really? Does that idea even make sense? It's one that I am part of a community that believes this, you know? So what is that, right? So that was one. And then the second was an experience that my dad had in his work as a contractor of having a group client. They were building a mosque for this client, in fact, that was led by a community of very devout Muslim people. And as my dad got to know these folks and encountered their devotion and their practice and their understanding of the divine, he was like, I don't know, that seems like it works just as good as this. You know, like that's just as valid as, what's the difference? I mean, we got some different words, but, you know, so that, again, so that's those are both stories that I can remember hearing from him. And I feel like I could almost like hear the physical grinding of gears in his head when he told those stories. Or to use one of my mom's metaphors, I feel like I could see the smoke coming out of his ears. Like there was stuff going on in there, right? The sense of cognitive dissonance was so high, these conflicting desires to be a person who was true to his stated and his religious community stated beliefs, while also being true to what I would call his nature, his inherent curiosity, and his quick, inquisitive mind. And sometimes those things did not play nice together. Although we never had this conversation out loud, in my lived experience of what I saw Dad do with this dilemma, that's the part that remains instructive for me. He might have told me about some of these conundrums. Maybe he knew I would share his intrigue. And so he told me about some of the conundrums, maybe because of that. But as far as I know, he never chose to carry those dilemmas as though they should be everyone else's dilemma as well, if that makes sense. I didn't put this down as one of the lessons, but I feel like if there's a corollary lesson to this, it's the lesson that when it comes to making good worlds together, good societies together, it's not even what we believe as much as how we carry what we believe. I don't think I said that like it was an either or. I don't mean that, but that's not a binary. There's a blend there. How we carry what we believe matters very much, not just what we believe. His ability to kindly and generously share space, even religious and community space, with those whose beliefs were different than his, remains something that I aspire to. Don't let what you were taught get in the way of your curiosity. Lesson number two. Dad also taught me that as humans, we are more than what we own and also more than what we do. And I think that first value, more than what we own, I think that one came easier to him than the second. My mom liked to tell the story of how when my dad proposed to her, he said that he couldn't promise that they would not be poor, but he could promise that as long as he was able, he would work as hard as he could to provide for their family. Now, they both grew up somewhere between relatively and dirt poor. Like, they grew up with not a lot. So that was a pretty meaningful reference point, I think. And in the early going, I mean, I only have this from stories and the occasional picture, but when I listen to the stories and I look at the pictures, I think in the early years, that commitment took a fair bit of determination and sweat and goodwill and ingenuity just to kind of keep the wheels on sometimes. But it turned out okay, much to my mom's continued astonishment. I think she was still shaking her head when she died that there was you know, money in the bank and all of that. And I don't want to speak for anybody else on this matter, but for me, it is tempting to get sucked into this prevailing cultural norm of you are what you own. And I have some landmark experiences where I made decisions in my own interest that had to do with owning things. Not typically very big things, but things that mattered to me, where subsequent to those experiences, I realized what I did to get that had pinned to it this notion that that would make my life better, and it hasn't. And that's been the hinge of this lesson for me. But the temptation is still there, this draw of defining myself or defining others on the basis of socioeconomic status. Or if not that, then being tempted by the mythology, which I feel like we're just swimming in these days, that happiness is a purchasable thing. Dad's wisdom reminds me of how tenuous and ephemeral all of that is. So that's, we're more than what we own. That second part, we're more than what we do, that feels like wisdom that is harder to hang on to. In both my heart and my lived experience, I know enough to say that I believe that that is true. We are more than what we do. But with any diminishment in capacity, even of the most temporary sort, I find myself confronted by how challenging that idea is to hold on to. That's a hard one. And to be clear, I'm not simply talking about decline because of age, stage, gravity, life challenges, you know, all the usual suspects. I'm talking about how life comes with vagaries, how life comes complete with uncertainties. For example, nobody, at least nobody that I'm aware of or know, asked to be part of a pandemic, but it happened anyway. And it hit everyone somehow, and some people devastatingly. It's been hard on communities of all sorts, including on this one. We have collectively reduced how much we are doing collectively. And even under those sorts of circumstances, we still might find ourselves wrestling with how best to see value in ourselves and in one another as fellow human beings. This is, and this remains quite intriguing to me, one of the strengths of many religions and worldviews is that have some sort of creator mythology. This is one of the strengths of those mythologies. Those kinds of stories that we have a creator in common, however we understand that creator idea inside the mythology, those kinds of stories can provide a reference point for human value entirely aside from owning or doing. Why does a human have value? How do we answer the question? Well, lots of those systems answer the question is because you were made by a creator who values you. You are connected to it. So in a creation mythology that in which creator is the earth, is everything that's alive, you have value because you're part of this living web of this web of life. So you have value just because of that. And so on, right? So those stories have a lot of power in that regard. And it seems to me that those kinds of stories can sometimes make it a bit easier to consider what social equity looks like or why we might care for those that might not be productive in the capitalist sense of that word. Why we might talk or think differently about those whose lives end by their choice, whether that's by suicide or by medically assisted dying. You know, like all that stuff kind of shifts. It all kind of works around some of these bigger ideas. For my dad, who was a doer all his life, who found the crippling effects of arthritis and later cancer deeply challenging, I mean, arguably who wouldn't, but there's a connection to the doing aspect for him that I could really clearly see. For him, there remained a kind of, even in that struggle, there remained a kind of equanimity about his place in the world that was anchored in something greater, more mysterious, and harder to access than buying or building tend to be. It was bigger than that. And it really mattered. It made a huge difference. I would say, I'm still working on this one, Dad. You know, grateful for your example. This doesn't settle easy. Lesson number 3. My dad also taught me that you can do love without a lot of words. And sometimes you still need words. If you haven't heard me say it in so many words just yet, my dad didn't use a lot of words to make his point. His oldest kid didn't grow up anything like him in that regard. He tended to enact what he believed. He tended to live it out. And sometimes that looked a bit stern, especially on the surface, but underneath there was this consistent, substantive blend of determination and tenderness that I believe helped all of his adult kids have a deep-seated confidence that we were in the final event loved. There was some pretty good attachment stuff that happened in the early going for all of us, I think. That's the, in some ways, the without words part. For me as a feeler, the kind of person for whom words really matter, I found it very important to hear "I love you" articulated. That really mattered to me. It wasn't until I was in my later teens that I figured that out and I communicated it to my dad. I don't know if this ever really made sense to my dad at an intuitive level, at that level where you get it from the inside out, if you want to put it that way. But I do know what he did with that input and what he did with so many other problems that he faced. He broke it down into some pieces and went to work on it. He learned how to say, "I love you," out loud. I watched it happen. It's kind of astonishing, right? I mean, how hard is it? You know what I mean? It's not about the mechanics of it, is it? It's about something else. But he learned that something else. He did this. And he was, as any of us are with something new, a bit clumsy at first. I could see the effort. I could hear the lag. I could watch him remember and then do. You know, it happened in view, right? But he did it. And he got better at it until, I would say, by the end, it came pretty naturally. And I think, in some ways that I can't even really articulate, he learned how to weave it into other everyday words as well. He learned other ways to say it without it just being rigidly bound to that phrase or those words. And one of the ways, well, this will be messy. It's an important story. But one of the ways that he learned how to do that was people's names and the way he would say people's names. Last word he ever said to me, "It's my name." It's one word. I was leaving the room. He was dying. That was it. Tim. So much, right, in that word. So, he learned how to do it. And, of course, the both endness again, of course there was also this lifetime of enacting, this lifetime of demonstrating the love that gave those words their mysterious substance, right? Gave them their, if you will, their power. Well, there's lots more. But I'm just going to toss in a couple of short ones, and then I'm going to end with one that feels like it has become more and more important to me as life has progressed. First short one, if you're counting, I guess it would be lesson number 4, is the lesson that it's okay to change your course, but make sure that where you're headed still fits with what you value the most. And this is, among other things, the kind of thinking that brought me to the table, even when it might not have been the most obvious next step. I've never been a careerist, but this would not have been a career move if I was. And it's also what keeps me here, even when it's challenging, right? And there's the value piece is that I value the freedom to explore. And I value communities that do the work of making space for that. That's not exclusive to the table, of course, but it is central to it. And underneath that, for me, is my dad's willingness to both consider changes and also to stay the course, always guided by what he valued the most, you know? More job security, bigger paycheck. Those things could have been part of that decision, but they would have come with distinctly less freedom to think and act in ways that lined up with what I value the most, which is room to explore. And I'd been in the religion business long enough to know that. And this has been and continues to be so much better, the right choice in so many ways. Second short lesson number 5, I could illustrate in almost the same way, is, and I can hear my dad's voice, I can see where we were when I heard him say this as a sentence for the first time. If there's no risk, where's the fun in that? Okay, so as I was saying, the table. And here's the last one, lesson number 6, which I mentioned in another context recently, but upon reflection, I realized that one of the reasons it was resonant for me and that I accessed it in that other setting is because it originated for me with my dad. So lesson number six is that we start where we are and we get better from there. When I was a kid, one of the things I remember is my dad's construction company built what's called a spec home at one point. You pay for it yourself, and then you build it, and then you sell it. And then I think, I don't know exactly how this all went down. I was a little young to know the ins and outs of it. But anyhow, somehow it ended up being our house. I don't know if it wouldn't sell. I don't know if Mom walked in and looked around and went, why are we living over there? I have no idea how that went down. But we ended up living there. And so we were building a deck on the back of that house, which was always just known curiously by its model name, which was the Castleton, which is when I think about the house now, I think about how grandiose that name is and what the house was. It's really kind of all funny. But anyway, we were building a deck on the back, and I wanted to help. I don't know how old I was. I mean, I was like 7 or 8, maybe something in there. This is before the days of pneumatic nailers, so all those spikes that held that deck together had to be pounded in by hand, and you did tend to use spikes and not construction screws back then, so it was lots of hammering going on. My dad was really skillful with a hammer, and he always used this little finishing hammer. I mean, we did lots of commercial construction. His company did a lot of heavy stuff, and so he had these crew guys who had these like giant framing hammers. I don't know if any of this means anything to anybody, but these things have got a big head, they're heavy, they're long. Dad uses this little tiny finesse kind of hammer for everything. And the guys would just make fun of him, but he got just as much work done with that little hammer. But it was like watching a hummingbird compared to a vulture or something. Like, it was just like this bing, 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 bing compared to bam, smash, you know. So he kind of had this whole thing, but he could really do stuff with a hammer. So he's making this deck with his, you know, little finishing hammer. And I'm watching him pounding nails, and I want to know how to do it. And he was like, okay, I'll teach you how to pound nails. So he gave me a hammer, gave me some nails. He's like, so you set the nail, and then you pound it in. You just keep it going until it's done, and this is when it's done. And kind of put me to work on a corner of the deck. I can't imagine what this corner of the deck looked like by the time I was done. But I was not doing awesome. There were some nails of the other kind that were getting hit, and, you know, nails of the metal kind that weren't necessarily behaving themselves and going in. And he watched that for a while, and then he was like, Tim, you're doing great, and I think I need to teach you how to steer the nail. I'm like, you know, I mean, even now when I think back on it, I remember feeling like... You steer a car, you steer a bike, you know, like nails are not a thing you steer. And he's like, no, here's how you do it. So you put the nail here, you set it so it doesn't go away when you take your hand off it. And then when you start to drive it in, if it's going this way, you just change the angle of the head of the hammer a little bit. You still keep hitting it square, but the force changes because you change this angle. If it goes that way, you change the angle this way, and you can steer the nail. And he'd drive it in crooked on purpose and then straighten it out, and he'd show me how it worked, right? You can steer the nail. Taught me how to steer the nail. Then he just let me practice and make a mess. I can still steer the nail. Like, it works. It's a real thing. When I look back on that experience, the bigger lesson, which didn't surface until much later for me, was that we can all start where we are and get better. That all that mess making that goes with learning, that's just part of the deal. That's part of how we learn. We don't have to, the A-type in me does not want to make a mess of the corner of the deck learning how to steer the nail. I want to learn it from a book and then go out there and put the nail in the deck and hit it 4 times and it goes in straight and it's clean at the top. I want to do it perfectly the first time. And I'd like to not have anybody around until, if it takes more than one try, until I'm that good at it. You know? Thank you very much. I don't think that's the way it works. I don't even think that's a good way for it to work at this point. I think having, whether it's persons, environments, organizations, ideas around us that can help us feel supported and safe while we're learning that messy stuff in non-judgmental ways that makes room for the value of the process and not just the outcome, those are the kind of spaces where I think we learn and grow and are the best. Those spaces, making those spaces cost somebody something. I cannot imagine. No, I can now. A little bit. But what was going on inside of my dad when he had to turn his back on that corner of the deck and just let me have my way with it in the process of learning how to do this, knowing that forever a deck that he built was going to have a corner on it that looked like it was nailed together by somebody who clearly did not have competencies that he had. But that's what he did. I don't think it reduced the overall value of the house in the end. Or maybe they just sat the barbecue on it. But whatever it was, he made that space. I remember that as a very non-threatening, positive learning experience that I still use as an illustration when I'm talking about the process of learning in good ways. Pretty lovely. I think that all of this bundled together in lots of ways applies to much of life, not least of all to exploring what we believe. We might have been taught that it's the outcome, particularly getting the right answer, that matters. At this point, personally, I would be very hard to convince of that, not least of all because I've seen the wisdom of start where you are and build from there, and I've seen it demonstrated not just by my father to me when I was a young learner, but over and over and over again. I'm pretty sold on this. Not again, not in a black and white way, but in a way that it kind of feels like a deep current in my life. And for that, and for so much more, I have my father to thank. So, on this Father's Day, thanks, Dad. Peace.